Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 153, and we're going to be taking a look at some information from the archives in a variety of different ways, and from a variety of different archive programs, and we're going to be taking a look, as I'm recording this on October 15th of the year 2000, at a past presidency, namely the presidency of Richard Nixon. There has been a recent book by Anthony Summers about Richard Nixon making a number of different charges concerning our elder statesman, as he came to be known. One of the things that has not received a lot of publicity in connection with Richard Nixon is the fact that there are some very strong connections between the Watergate scandal and the assassination of President Kennedy. I've talked about those in numerous broadcasts. The Guns of November Part 3, which are going to be you're going to hear excerpted, that was recorded on November 15th. Of 1983. I've talked about that in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits, and we've reflected on that in a number of different broadcasts as well. Most recently, in For the Record program number 104, I noted that Anthony Pelicano, the private investigator who worked for Mark Furman in the O.J. Simpson case, had given testimony that the 18.5-minute tape gap on one of the Watergate tapes could actually have been accidentally erased by Richard Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods. That same Anthony Pelicano also gave information with regard to the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation that maintained that the fourth shot from the grassy knoll, which led the committee to conclude that there had been a conspiracy in Kennedy's assassination, Anthony Pelicano said that that was simply an error, that there was, in fact, no fourth shot. So one should note that there are evidentiary tributaries running between the past and the present, and that Anthony Pelicano, who laps upon the shores of Mark Furman's world, also weighed in during the Watergate investigation and said that, nah, the 18.5-minute tape gap was just an accident. I would note in that regard that among the many connections between Watergate and the Kennedy assassination, first of all, Richard Nixon himself, who was in Dallas, Texas on 11-22-63, flew out right about the time Kennedy was being killed, or a couple of hours before. Yet when the interview, when the FBI interviewed him on February 28th of 1964, Richard Nixon said that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas was 2 days prior to the assassination. This despite the fact that the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, among other newspapers, carried a UPI interview with Nixon in Dallas on November 21st in their November 22nd editions, in which he says, among other things, that he was going to do everything possible to get John F. Kennedy out of office. That, of course, that interview was conducted a day after Nixon claims that he left Dallas, Texas. Leon Jaworski, who was named by Richard Nixon as Watergate special prosecutor, had been a Warren Commission counsel in charge of seeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had connections to the intelligence community. Oswald had many connections to the intelligence community, but Leon Jaworski, himself an individual who sat on the board of directors of the MD Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit, concluded, not surprisingly, that Lee Harvey Oswald had no connections to the intelligence community. Oswald, of course, was a patsy in the Kennedy assassination, but nonetheless, the structuring of his situation in such a way as to prepare him to take the fall is very, very indicative. Gerald Ford, named by Richard Nixon to replace Spiro Agnew as vice president, had been a Warren Commission, a member of the Warren Commission. Ultimately, of course, Gerald Ford succeeded Richard Nixon as president and pardoned him of all crimes that he had committed. Those are just some of the many connections between Watergate and the Kennedy assassination. Bear in mind that in his book, The Ends of Power, H.R. Bob Haldeman, Nixon's White House chief of staff, stated that the whole Bay of Pigs thing, which was what Richard Nixon sought to keep secret, was a code word in the Nixon White House for the assassination of President Kennedy. Watergate has cropped up in the news again recently because a number of electronic experts have taken the challenge, or appear to be taking the challenge, to determine what, in fact, was on the 18.5-minute tape gap, that 18.5 minutes erased, according to Anthony Pelicano, Mark Furman's private investigator, accidentally. According to just about everybody else, that tape erasure has to have been deliberate. There is one exception, and we're going to come to that in a minute. The following article comes from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, September 22nd of the year 2000. This is an article by James Warren of the Chicago Tribune. It's datelined College Park, Maryland, and headlined, Archives may try to recover sound from erased Nixon tape. This article reads as follows. Clearly and audibly, the National Archives moved to investigate the possible recovery of the most famous 18-and-a-half-minute taped conversation ever erased. After a generally technical, bone-dry meeting Thursday of an advisory panel on preservation, the archives will experiment to see if new methods of voice extraction might be worth trying on the section of 28-year-old tape that helped bring down the presidency of Richard Nixon. It's the so-called 18-and-a-half-minute gap, in fact, 18 minutes and 28 seconds, in a conversation between Nixon and top aide H.R. Haldeman shortly after the Watergate break-in. Bear in mind, again, as I just said, that Haldeman, in his book The Ends of Power, stated that the whole Bay of Pigs thing, which is what Richard Nixon was afraid would come out if the Watergate cover-up was not affected, was a code word in the Nixon White House for the assassination of President Kennedy, and this 18-and-a-half-minute gap was in a conversation between Nixon and H.R. Haldeman, as indicated here. Continuing. The erasure is significant because it covered Nixon's first conversation on Watergate taped by his White House recording system after the 1972 break-in. It has long been assumed that someone intentionally erased the tape, though Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, said she did it accidentally. The gap and the subsequent allegations of obstruction of justice not only helped lead to Nixon's ultimate resignation, it also prompted congressional changes in the law involving presidential materials. Since then, most written and taped materials no longer are considered the exclusive property of a president. The conversation between Nixon and Haldeman, which is known to have been about Watergate because of Haldeman's written notes, was initially subpoenaed as part of the Watergate Special Prosecution Force's investigation. After the White House informed District Judge John Sirica, who oversaw the Watergate case, about the gap, the judge commissioned a panel of experts to examine the tape in 1974, their every move watched by U.S. Marshals. The original tape had been played just six times since 1974, the last time in 1992 for the purpose of creating copies on digital audio tape. There have been no attempts to enhance the tape, which is a 6.5-hour reel and part of the 3,500 hours of Nixon tapes, most of which are still being processed by the archives and yet to be heard by the American public. The tape with a gap has a bumpy preservation history, including brief stays in a closet across from a cafeteria at the old executive office building next door to the White House, and in a Virginia warehouse, where it was accidentally subjected to temperatures of 90 degrees on occasion. It is now secure and resting under the best conditions in a temperature-controlled vault at the archives in Washington. It was last inspected earlier this year and appears to be in good shape. Thursday's session involved a committee of experts from government and private industry. They discussed whether it is feasible, given improvements in technology, to recover sound on the tape, and if so, whether the process would damage the tape, which is now largely marked by a loud buzzing sound. The consensus was that it's highly unlikely that anything of value can be found on the gap. The majority clearly supports the findings of the 1974 panel of experts. Quote, "The tapes were not very intelligible in the best conditions and then were erased," unquote, said John McKnight, a member of the 1974 panel who is a sound expert at Magnetic Reference Laboratory of Mountain View. Quote, "It's commonly assumed that if you took the buzz away, there would be speech. I think we did everything we could do in 1974, unquote. Bruce Koenig, K-O-E-N-I-G, a former top forensic audio expert with the FBI who now runs a private firm in Clifton, Virginia called Bektek, that's capital B-E-K, capital T-E-K, all in capital letters, likened the situation to building a sandcastle on a beach, then knocking it down and returning 30 years later. However, the panel did have one clearly dissenting and effective voice in Stephen St. Croix of Baltimore's Intelligence Devices Incorporated, a speech extraction firm whose clients have included the archives and a major Hollywood studio that needed his help in preserving old movies. St. Croix sought to, as he put it, quote, chip away at the certainty, unquote, that recovering the conversation was not possible. To that end, he outlined the latest technology, which essentially uses computers to help replicate sounds. Despite his belief that he would have a better chance by using the original tape, sentiment grew in favor of simulating the original tape and testing that simulation as a means of inspecting such technology. The archives will begin a process of creating such a tape, then erase the recorded dialogue under the same conditions discerned by the 1974 panel, then throw open the test tube for anybody to provide what the archivists and scientists call a, quote, proof of concept, unquote. St. Croix, for one, was confident that at minimum he could erase all the frustrating background noise on the actual tape. But then, what would be left? Perhaps something dramatic, he said. Then again, perhaps he would wind up with a, quote, a beautiful, distortion-free nothing, unquote. Well, obviously, I'm in no position to say exactly what the panel of experts is going to come up with in their attempts to restore the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. I wouldn't hold my breath about anything dramatic coming out of that, simply because it is probable that the information on that 18-and-a-half-minute gap, which appears to have been a deliberate erasure, was quite damning. And what we're going to do in order to gain some perspective on propositions that the Nixon White House came up with to erase that, to erase the tapes, and in particular an individual who figured in Jim Garrison's investigation and whose name crops up in connection with White House aide Charles Colson's proposition to erase the Watergate tapes, we're going to revisit the archives, and we're going to go back to November 15th, 1983, and The Guns of November, Part 3. In addition to my own voice, in the excerpt you're about to listen to, you will hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. This, again, is from The Guns of November, Part 3, November 15th, 1983, and the discussion will resume in, will begin in the middle of an analysis of a number of figures that Jim Garrison tried to have extradited to New Orleans in order to pursue his investigation, but who, for one reason or another, did not wind up in New Orleans. This again from The Guns of November, Part 3.
Now, the third of the would-be the third of the people that Garrison tried to have extradited and was unable to do so was a guy named Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. Now, Novell was affiliated with the same anti-Castro, CIA-sponsored right-wing milieu in New Orleans in the South that we've been talking about. Now, he also was affiliated with the Bannister's, quote, detective agency, unquote. And Novell had deposed to Garrison in connection with an arms theft case connected with Bay of Pigs that a whole bunch of munitions taken from the Schlumberger company, intended for use by the Bay of Pigs brigade against Castro, had been stored overnight in Guy Bannister's detective agency. Again, this second floor walk-up with two addresses, one to right-wing Guy Bannister, one to left-wing alleged left-winger Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Garrison wanted to question Gordon Novell in connection with the Kennedy case. Novell split for Ohio, and Garrison filed an extradition request to then-Governor of Ohio John Rhodes. Is it John Rhodes? I know there was the minority leader was John Rhodes from Arizona, and it was Governor Rhodes of Ohio.
I believe it's Governor John Rhodes.
Rhodes. Anyway, Governor Rhodes, first name we may be wrong on, but Governor Rhodes of Ohio, and I think it's John Rhodes. Basically, he agreed to extradite Gordon Novell on the condition that Jim Garrison would not question him about the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, this is absurd, of course, because that was the very thing that Garrison was attempting to have Novell extradited in order to question him in connection with. So the governor of Ohio says, yeah, we'll grant the extradition request if you don't question him about the thing you want to question him about. And so that's who this fellow Gordon Novell is now. Pick up on his connections to Watergate.
That's right. That slays me. No pun intended. Okay, this little section we're reading here is from a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy, produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations under the direction of Bernard Fensterwald, Jr., coincidentally enough, James McCord's lawyer at a later point, and compiled by Michael Ewing. This particular book is published by Zebra Books, Kensington Publishing Corporation. It's copyright 1977. We're going to start out talking about Charles Colson, but Gordon Novell will crop up very quickly. Charles Colson, President Nixon's special counsel and widely hated hatchet man from 1969 to 1973, was the man who originally selected E. Howard Hunt to set up the secret White House plumbers. Colson, with a single exception of H.R. Haldeman, seems to have been involved in more of the horrors of the Nixon Rogues Gallery than any other aide. During his years with Nixon, Colson attained a well-deserved reputation as one of the meanest, most slippery, and dangerous men ever to serve in American government. Nixon himself had once remarked, quote, Colson would do anything. Colson had once been involved with one of Jim Garrison's former, quote, suspects in a mysterious plan to erase the Nixon Watergate tapes in March of 1974. This strange information first came to the surface in August of 1974, when Jack Anderson disclosed that Colson had met with New Orleans electronics specialist Gordon Novell in March 1974 and had begun developing plans for the magnetic erasure of various Nixon tapes. Novell, who had received national attention in 1967 as District Attorney Garrison's, quote, missing witness when he was under investigation for his reported contacts with both David Ferry and Clay Shaw. Novell and Coulson discussed the use of an experimental degaussing machine, which could project a magnetic beam into the Nixon tapes and erase them without having to handle them in any way. Anderson reported that Coulson had described some of the tapes as containing conversations that, quote, could cause the president's grief, and that Novell recalled that Coulson had also spoken of using the erasing machine to obliterate some secret recordings maintained by the CIA as well. Following his discussion with Coulson in March of 1974, Gordon Novell flew to Texas to see an associate and drew up a blueprint for the erasing plan, which he cryptically referred to as, quote, the El Paso matter, when he later sent the blueprint to Coulson by hand courier in Washington. Coulson claimed that the whole erasing idea was just, quote, a joke, and that he had discussed the plan only for, quote, a little bit of comic relief. Okay, well, without confusing you by trying to give you too much more on the Watergate thing itself, just bear that in mind. Here's Gordon Novell, a former Jim Garrison extradition request denied by John Rhodes unless they would agree not to talk to him about the very thing they wanted to extradite him for. Gordon Novell crops up in Watergate trying to help Charles Coulson, allegedly trying to help Charles Coulson erase the Watergate tapes. Coulson, on the other hand, turns around and calls it, quote-unquote, a joke. Okay. Now, this next two little bits here real quickly. This is something we ran across just a couple of years ago with help from Mae Russell, who found this for us, and we used it on One Step Beyond, and we're going to repeat it here. This is from Technology Illustrated magazine, and it's the April 1983 edition. Okay, and this first little bit is just a little introduction to an article, and it's written by, you know, somebody on the staff, and they're just introducing the article, and they say, last summer for spy tech, and this is meanings like summer of 82, so this is pretty recent. Last summer four spy tech luminaries gathered at a private 60-acre camp in Powder Springs, Georgia. Mitch Werbel, the host, known in military circles as, quote, the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons, Gordon Novell, a New Orleans entrepreneur and reputed offshore arms merchant, sometimes referred to as the Mad Bomber, Gordon Liddy, star of Watergate and his own autobiography, Will, and Lieutenant Colonel Alan Bell, U.S. Army, retired, one of the world's acknowledged experts in the field of electronic spycraft. Okay, now, that's just the intro that they use, mentioning Gordon Novell as being present with Liddy at Mitch Werbel's ranch, and Mitch Werbel's camp, actually, is what it is, and calling him and mentioning that he's sometimes known as the Mad Bomber. Now, interestingly enough here, in the Technology Illustrated for July of 1983, Mr. Novell takes pen in hand or typewriter in hand to write an article, to write a letter in himself. In the midst of his letter, where he is talking about different things, he says, quote, the only people, this is Gordon Novell himself, by the way, writing in response to that introduction in the article. He says, quote, the only people who have ever had the fortitudinal stupidity to call me, quote, the Mad Bomber are all now defendants in two ongoing federal civil suits totaling well over $2 billion in damages. This one-man war resulted mainly from my ultra-high technology counterintelligence role in Watergate to erase the White House tapes. Okay, so here's Charles Coulson on one hand talking about his contact with this ex-Garrison extradition request as being comic relief and a joke and basically saying it didn't happen. Here's Gordon Novell turning around in a letter to Technology Illustrated basically bragging about his high-tech role in Watergate.
Okay, now the Watergate tapes themselves and some of the controversy surrounding them might be worth covering at this point for those of you who may be scratching your heads and wondering just what this is all about. It was revealed during the course of the public White House, public Watergate hearing by a fellow by the name of Alexander Butterfield, that Nixon's White House had a taping system set up and that basically all conversations in the Oval Office had been taped. Now, these tapes were then requested by the special prosecutor set up by joint agreement between the president and Congress to prosecute any crimes connected with Watergate. Of course, these tapes became possible evidence and were subpoenaed as a result. Now, a number of the tapes turned up with very suspicious gaps. One in particular had a very famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the middle of it, which remains a source of controversy. So here we have Gordon Novell talking about erasing the Watergate tapes. Many of the tapes themselves have, to this day, unexplained gaps. And indeed, the gaps themselves have some interesting Kennedy-related connections. Nixon's secretary, a woman named Rosemary Woods, was one of the primary suspects in connection with the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. And facing possible prosecution, she retained a man named Charles Rhyne, R-H-Y-N-E, who was a legal observer to the Warren Commission and also a close personal friend of Richard Nixon. A lot of other Watergate connections we're going to go into. The GOP counsel, the minority counsel, was a guy named Albert Jenner, and he had been a Warren Commission counsel. So the Kennedy connection, there are many minor ones. We're going to go into some of the major ones here in just a second.
Okay, one of the other things that needs to be mentioned in context of the Nixon tapes is that one of the things that Richard Nixon at one point was, I believe, and I don't remember the exact person he was arguing whether he was talking to, but it was one of his aides, Richard Nixon, and this is in the transcripts once once this came out, and you can find it, I believe, in places, in a variety of places, but Richard Nixon said, literally, one of the reasons that the tapes should not be revealed because they were going to bring up this whole, and I quote Richard Nixon, this whole Bay of Pigs thing. Now, in and of itself, that is very interesting because, according to popular theory, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, embarrassing as it might have been for America, was all known. The Bay of Pigs invasion was started, and it failed. Well, one has to ask a series of questions about why Richard Nixon would be so worried, and he was worried, as the conversation showed, about this whole Bay of Pigs thing. And we've talked in the past about his role in planning the Bay of Pigs, which was also pretty well known. But we've also mentioned two possibilities. One is the fact of the CIA scotching their own Bay of Pigs, and the other is the possibility that the scotching of the Bay of Pigs led in part to the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay, and worth noting, too, that Nixon ran against Kennedy in 1960, and the Bay of Pigs was one of Kennedy's main embarrassments, and here's Nixon trying to cover the thing up. Talking about also about the tape gaps, too. At one point, Nixon, and in his reference to the whole Bay of Pigs thing, at one point Nixon was considering, in fact, asked former Warren Commission chief counsel J. Lee Rankin to go over the tapes to help edit out national security-related matter. Rankin declined, by the way. So, again, this, the same cast of characters crops up.
That, again, from The Guns of November, Part 3, that recorded on November 15th of 1983. And again, in addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Bear in mind that as we discussed in The Guns of November, Part 3, and as we discussed in Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits, a miscellaneous archive show from 1994 made after Nixon passed away, Nixon himself was in Dallas, Texas, as we noted earlier in the broadcast, and lied about it to the FBI. His dissembling with regard to his presence in Dallas, Texas would have been enough information, or it was basically sufficient to convict him of perjury and to indict him for the murder of President Kennedy. If someone can be proved to have lied or otherwise misrepresented information in order to cover up a crime, it's considered prima facie evidence for indicting that person for the crime that they attempted to cover up. So that may very well hold a clue as to what exactly was on that 18-and-a-half-minute gap, and also what it was that Richard Nixon was afraid of if the Watergate tapes were released. Now, note in particular the curious position of Gordon Novell, one of the people involved in Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans, and the fact that White House aide Charles Colson had recruited Gordon Novell at one point to erase the Watergate tapes. Also note that in Technology Illustrated, the technology publication alluded to in that, or actually excerpted in that particular tape segment, Gordon Novell made reference to his ultra-high technology role in erasing the Watergate tapes, or studying the feasibility of erasing the Watergate tapes. A very, very interesting comment indeed. This is Gordon Novell was rebutting some of what he viewed as critical commentary in that technology publication. We're going to excerpt to Miscellaneous Archive Show M3 on the other side of this program, and we're going to hear what Gordon Novell had to say for himself in an impromptu interview, and I think his comments prove very, very interesting indeed. Let me remind you, first of all, that all of the various tapes that I've alluded to, and as well as The Guns of November that you heard excerpted, are available from a tape duplication service. The name of that service is called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's Post Office Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, that's Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. That's mail at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. The For the Record segments have mini article-length descriptions on the web, and beginning with the description for the Record program 233, they are sourced. The sources for each piece of information are rigorously annotated. Please note that I am rewriting descriptions for the archive shows as I record this on October 15th of the year 2000. On the other side of this tape, we're going to listen to what Gordon Novell had to say for himself with regard to having been recruited by Charles Colson to erase the Watergate tapes. That concludes Side A of For the Record program number 153, again being recorded on 10/15/2000. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.